Welcome to the Social Standard Podcast. I'm Jessica Phillips, and I'm the founder and CEO of The Social Standard, a full-service influencer marketing agency. As a leader, I'm always striving to set new standards in our industry. My goal with this podcast is to highlight those who are doing the same. On each episode, our guests will take us through their own journey, what motivated and inspired them to try something new, and how they ultimately set the standard in their field. On top of that, they will provide actionable insights and ideas on how you can set the standard in your own way. So grab a cup of coffee and let's get to it. What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Social Standard Podcast. I'm super excited about our guest today, who is Dimitri Cherner, and he is the Director of Influencer and Partnerships for Ruggable. So if you guys don't know, Ruggable is the super hip company that has done like amazing things for the rug world. They have taken a beautiful, beautiful area rug and made it washable and a whole bunch of different other types of rugs now. So as a mom and a puppy mom, I am super excited about their product. I think it was something that the market absolutely needed. And based on the success that they have seen so far, I think most people are probably agreeing. So Dimitri, welcome. What's up? How are you?
Thank you for having me in that really nice intro. Yeah. I'm doing good. I'm excited to talk to you.
Totally. Well, I will say the reason there, either I say three probably good reasons I'm excited to chat with you, right? So number one, we had a killer conversation the other week, and it's for me personally, it's always really awesome to talk to people who know the space inside and out and are living and breathing it. So there are so many different points of view that you have that I don't quite get to see, you know, brand versus agency side. So we had a killer conversation. You also are a grad of IU, which go Hoosiers, so go myself Hoosiers. As well. That's the only way to be. And then you were in Alaska when we spoke. So anyone who's going to take a phone call from Alaska and just even travel to Alaska, big points in my book. So well done. I think it's going
to
be awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, my wife was born and raised in Alaska, and you know, so that's cool. Why we get to go there. So it's, I don't want to act like I'm so cool that I travel to Alaska regularly. I do, mostly to see family. But yeah, I'll take it.
But it's a cool place. I mean, it's, you know,
gorgeous.
Not a place that many people, I think, get to visit. So the fact that you go there on the regular is pretty awesome.
Yeah, highly recommend if you get a chance.
Totally. So I guess I want to start out just talking a little bit about you. I mean, you've had a really interesting career, right? I mean, you've got SEO skills under your belt. You were worked at an MCN for a while. You're over at Zephyr. Now you're at Ruggable. It's been kind of an interesting career path. The one I think has really created like this dream candidate, I would think, for someone like Ruggable with the approach that they've had. So tell us a little bit about kind of where you've been and what you've done before Ruggable.
Yeah. So, you know, I graduated from IU in 2012. I knew, you know, it's funny, like there's people at Ruggable who graduated more recently and they majored in social media. And like I majored in media and communications thinking, you know, I took courses that would like build, you know, we'd break up into groups and do long form ad campaigns for a given client over the course of an entire semester. And like,
that's awesome.
Paid media was never a part of those. Social wasn't a part of those. Influencers weren't a part of those. So it's so funny to see.
That's so weird because you graduated like 2 years ago, right? So.
Well, almost 10 years ago.
I know. I'm just giving
you
a little.
Which is terrifying to think about. Let's just glide right past that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's so I knew I wanted to do like digital marketing, and just kind of got my foot in the door. Like you mentioned, SEO, like managing a Facebook, you know, page, that kind of stuff. And then graduated over to the YouTube MCN, where that was my first experience working with content creators. Really good, like cut my teeth from the ground up, started as an intern. And left as an operations manager because I'm just generally very interested in processes and how things work and
sure.
How things can be made better. So I was just constantly looking at, you know, what can we improve here? How can this be made to run a little bit more smoothly? Like, how can we improve communications between teams, stuff like that? That's, you know, kind of nerdy, but that's what I like.
Yeah.
And so I was helping on the network side to grow channels. That was really good fundamental experience around just like, how do you grow your channel? How often do you post? And like, do you hop on trends and hashtags, keywords, that kind of stuff? And then on the brand integration side, the network was pretty small. So we were first forced to work and pitch talent that were outside of our network. So was able to build a lot of relationships with managers and agents who have now gone on to do amazing things. And I'm honored to be able to say that I know them in some capacity. That was really good, just foundational experience. Then I moved over to the agency side, kind of going, from the minors to the majors, much bigger brand deals with blue chip clients that were, expected the best. There was very little room for people learning on the job, and so my role operationally was to create like as efficient a process as possible across the team and with external stakeholders. That's what I did. I worked with sales teams, I worked internally, and just try to make our teams accountable and make our campaigns not only obviously as creative as possible, but as effective as possible. Again, kind of going from network to agency and then over to Ruggable on the brand side, it's been able to give me some really interesting perspectives on how each of the different parties work together, from the ground up and like from the inside out. And it's been amazing. Like I love working at Ruggable, and they've provided me with a lot of faith in the influencer program to be able to do cool things and to scale the program up, which I know a lot of D2C marketers like they struggle with that. Leaders, they have to for like really convince leadership to get on board. And obviously, there's always an element of that, but they had faith from the beginning, and that's kind of why they hired me to lead it.
And did they, so were they already doing an influencer program before you started, or was that brand new with your hire?
They were technically sending rugs to influencers, but it was just like people who were sliding into the DMs.
Yeah,
And
just seeding some product and stuff.
yeah, and as soon as I looked at like the people who were sliding into the DMs, it was a lot of like, micro influencers who had bought all their followers and like just trying to say that they were. And so like it became really clear that like we needed to really reestablish who we were sending rugs to and, create proper guidelines. So essentially I built a program from scratch and implemented processes and operational workflows so that we were, really vetting quality influencers and working within budgets and tracking as many data points as possible to know what was working and what wasn't.
Well, that's a
You'll hear
full-time
me.
job in and of itself, right?
Yeah, that's you'll hear me say a lot like test and learn. It's like that methodology is core
100%.
to Ruggable and obviously to a lot of D2C marketers. It's what you have to do because there's no one size fits all strategy. When it comes to influencer, it's always a mix of like, even something as specific as like your average order value. Like ours is going to be higher than a beauty brand lipstick or palette. So like you're not going to get as many, straight out of Instagram sales. And so we try to account for that. And I look at where else we're providing value to show like the effectiveness of the program.
Yeah, and I think that's a really smart point, right? Is when you look at influencers, I think especially a lot of D2C brands who have smaller average order values, I think they absolutely look at it more as like this pure ROI basis, right? And it kind of falls into the paid media camp. But then you have almost on the exact opposite, a lot of people are just using them for content. And you don't, I really don't see quite as many people, maybe until the last, I would say, 2 years, marrying the two, because it is hard to get those teams to talk to each other. But it's so important, right? I mean, to get both of those, it's crazy. And I know we'll get into that in a little bit. I don't want to put the cart before the horse here. But I wanted to chat just a little bit about, your director of influencer and partnership. So to me, titles are what titles are, but the fact that there is that level with influencer in it at Ruggable means that they clearly value the influencer business. And you're saying, hey, I came in and kind of had to sell it in. Like, how did you approach your coworkers when you're saying, hey, this is a program we've got to do? How did you convince them that this was worth testing and learning, to use your words?
Like I said, they had they Ruggable does a lot of like knowledge sharing with other brands, and so through those, the leadership team had heard and was almost already convinced that influencer was valuable and that it was worth developing and investing in a program. So even in my interview process, our CMO was like, we know we want to do it. We need somebody to show us how to do it and then how to scale it. And so that was almost, you know, even more so than the this beginning blocks of, you know, why do we do this in the first place? You know, taken care of. But regardless, you know, starting a program from scratch with a smaller budget that had to be proven out, it still required a lot of, kind of like what you mentioned, marrying multiple things that you wouldn't think to be completely organic and natural to put together into the program. So from the outset, you know, I was getting full licensing and usage rights for content, because then I immediately created a process by which I was sharing all the content out to our marketing team. Then it was used in paid ads. Then it was used on a website, email, social.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Very quickly, we started to see stronger results through their test and learn methodology. So even though I was still tied to, you know, CPA, CPC results through discount codes and trackable links in the organic performance of the influencers, it was there was secondary, tertiary things that I was still pointing to and saying, this is super, super valuable. And we should continue to invest and say, you know, if we could do more of this, it could lead to X, Y, and Z. And as a result of that, you know, over the past 2 years, we've actually spun up multiple verticals dedicated to those originally tertiary, now primary, and like really, I think, like innovative programs to develop super strong content and support launches and not just have an evergreen, you know, always on program. And looking at other marketing channels that we can support.
Sure. And do you mean like, I guess, are you saying that the, like some of the tertiary stuff or like the doormats, for example, that you guys hadn't gotten into, but then has been like, it's been a bigger launch in the last year, right?
Yeah. Yeah. That was pretty big. We got a really positive response from that. But not even really like product launches,
gotcha.
More so like, I mean, it really, the two main things is ROI and content. So like the performance of the posting, the content, and then a whitelisting has been an absolute boon for us. It's been, and I'm sure you're seeing this across every client that you talk
to,
like Facebook is even finally being like, all right, yes, it works really well. Now let's like have our teams kind of support you and do this and that. I like to think that we were ahead of the curve, but there's, you know, lots of brands who are doing it really, really well. And we are simply, again, testing and learning and scaling. So that's been a huge, huge benefit to that.
Well, and I really like what you said about, it's almost like a holistic view to influencers, right? You're not just saying, hey, it's a, you know, got to be 100% ROI focus or 100% content. That marrying that package together is so powerful. And when we look at, I'm sure you guys have done some of this too, but for a lot of our clients that we help with this, we tend to say, all right, micro influencers, smaller influencers are great. Like give them a code, track it. We're really going to like partner with these guys for the content though, right? You guys need to repurpose it here. And then we want to whitelist it on social. And what a lot of our clients have seen is that the content that the influencers are creating is outperforming their own internal brand content, you know, 2 to 5 times better performance in terms of like engagement and click-throughs than what the brand is producing in-house.
Yes. We're seeing the same thing.
Okay.
And it's actually why we've started to, one of the verticals that I mentioned that we spun up is, it's a production support channel. So rather than getting content from our evergreen program, which is funneling in on a regular basis, we are working with, you know, just like a typical campaign, we're gathering a smaller number of more curated influencers with a very specific objective. Not for posting and performance, but actually for content creation. So it actually started as a result of the pandemic. Our production team couldn't go out on location and do shots, shoots. So we started working with influencers and provided like detailed shot lists, really specific guidelines around what we were looking for and what it would be repurposed for, and started to receive just like phenomenal content. And now we have a dedicated person in charge of that. It's a part of every campaign going forward. And it's really only in the beginning stages. Like I see a lot more opportunity there.
That's great. So, I mean, you're saying that that content is performing so well. It's almost like, I don't want to say you don't need an in-house content studio, but you're effectively saying influencers are so successful. We're putting one person in charge of managing all of that. But instead of managing a production team, they're managing influencers.
Yeah, essentially.
Okay.
And I think the production team is obviously super valuable. Specifically, I mean, all around, but even more so, like with video, with influencers, it's a lot of work
It
to
is.
create these shot lists and get the lighting right and get the focus right, especially with rugs.
Yeah.
There's always a mix of like, well, how detailed do I get and how close up should I get and should, it's even things as like, ooh, there's like a somewhat loose thread on that shot. And so obviously there's a post-production process, we can clean that up, but like generally, production teams are obviously super valuable for getting the most specific stuff and for the highest quality like video content, I think. Although,
Yeah.
I think influencers are quickly catching up on that too.
I totally agree, especially those that have their roots in YouTube, right?
Oh yeah.
That's, I mean, that's on. And then when you think about like TikTok too, it's like now there are, for a while, it felt like we were kind of at, a status quo with the amount of platforms that were available. But in the last year and a half, it's been like gangbusters, right? And it's distracting, but it also requires a tremendous amount of content for brands to continue to push out. And you cannot put the same thing on YouTube as you do like on Instagram and TikTok, because it just, the platforms are so different. And I remember my old company, Hello Society, I remember we were meeting with Pinterest back in the day, right when Pinterest was like still pretty cool. And I remember their head of sales was like, "We would love for you guys to produce a ton of content for brands." And my nod to that was like, "Why would I want to do that? There's no money in that." And then flip to now, and it's like, there's so much money now in content. So, it was, you always got to make the decision that's right for the time. And I'm not sure if she was ahead of the times or just trying to like redirect our business model so that, they could do their thing without us interfering.
Benefited them a little bit more, yeah.
Probably. But it's just so interesting because it is, yeah, I mean, content creation is huge, and we've seen that a lot too, right? Especially in the last year. We've done so many production shoots, with we're literally shipping equipment to some people, and we've got, the brand and their agency like on the phone, sorry, on Zoom, and they're going through everything and they're seeing it almost in real time. It's pretty unbelievable what we've been able to do in the last year. It's maybe a little more stressful than I think we'd all probably like to admit, but the fact that we were able to accomplish it is pretty awesome.
Yeah, the evolution is really interesting. And I love the point you brought up about like every brand is expected to be on every platform and they're expected to be able to do it amazingly. And you cannot repurpose content across platforms. Like maybe you could recut it to format the right size, but very quickly, usually within the first 3 seconds, you're like, eh, this doesn't really work here. And so Ruggable, just like every other brand, has had to be like, all right, so what's the best opportunity here? Should this be in-house? Should this be via influencer? Should this be via this specific vertical for influencers that also includes production? And we've tried to diversify as much as possible, but it's a lot of work because for each one, it requires its own creative, it requires its own production, it requires its own guidelines. And then, especially when you're working with influencers, even people that you've worked with in the past and that you trust to do things really well, sometimes they miss the mark. And it's just a part of the game, it's an ongoing restructuring and creative process that is fun, but a ton of work. And so it's for us, it's really just about managing resources. Where do we think it makes the most sense to hire an influencer for this or have the production team do that? But it is definitely keeps us all on our toes, I'll say that.
I bet. How big is your team?
The influencer team is 6 people plus myself, so seven total.
That's a lot.
It's a solid, it's a
I
good
mean,
sized team.
if you think, and are they all focused on different platforms, or you kind of all come together as a group and divide and conquer?
Come together as a group. I have someone who's focused on a broad whitelisting strategy. I have a couple people who are working, half with existing Instagram talent and half with like outside agents and managers. Another who's focused on TikTok and YouTube and like really trying to conquer those because the majority of what we've done has been on Instagram. So even though YouTube has been is a legacy platform that's been around, it's just I've always struggled with like how you make a brand integration about a rug truly interesting, because I refuse to like I mean, there's always an element of like, the influencer who holds up the skincare bottle and she's smiling. And for us, in order to scale, we had to templatize a little bit. So yes, we have a lot of influencer content that is a beautiful room with a family sitting on the floor or something like that. But when it came to YouTube, I really honestly always struggled with like, okay, so and now for the sponsor, sponsored by Ruggable, and like, here's my machine washable rug, and
But I mean, I would
we've
push you guys on
tested.
that. I don't know. I mean, I get your general point, and I can 100% see that. But I gotta say, there's so many foodies on influencer, or sorry, on YouTube that are cooking, and it's like that rug in the kitchen, number one, is very coveted, and number two, those guys are flinging pasta sauce and everything
Yes.
everywhere all the time. It's I think it could be a really great integrate. I'm gonna ping you some folks after this who I think you should check out because I mean, I know you guys have a different space, right? Being in the interior space, I think Instagram is your market, right? There is
Yes.
probably not going to be a better platform for you guys than Instagram. However, on the DTC side, YouTube is what just crushes for everyone, right? I think, I know, you know, the Social Center has been one agency that's been able to do ROI-driven campaigns on Instagram, and that's why we get a lot of like buzz within the DTC community, but YouTube is so easy and it's long tail and you know it just goes on and on and on. And then even TikTok, we've been seeing incredibly low CPAs coming off of TikTok, which you know you got to look at the maturation of the platform. And you know the longer you wait to get on TikTok, the long you know the higher the cost is going to be to start playing,
Right.
right? And but you guys have done that, right? You've already started on TikTok.
We've started on TikTok, yes, and we're seeing some strong early results. But it,
Strong. You guys are
yeah,
already at like 50,000 followers almost, aren't you?
we had one video goes like super viral.
That's how TikTok works. That's all you need.
And it totally, exactly, like I love it. But it's really funny. I curated a lot of influencer content for TikTok. And I thought like that's what would perform really well because that kind of like lo-fi, truly organic, like we wanted to make it interesting and punchy, content would work really well.
Yeah.
And the video that ended up going viral was like a studio produced, like creative. I think it's hilarious, and I'm really glad it did go viral because it's like this girl who's holding up this really small wine glass,
Oh,
and the
yeah, I
other
saw
girl's
that.
holding up a giant like bottle of wine, and she's just dumping all of it. And then she drops like a piece of cheese and she's like, oh my God, what did you like? Why are you ruining my rug? So I think that that somehow worked.
That's humor, right? That I mean, a humor
Yeah.
works so well on TikTok. So,
Absolutely.
well, good for you guys, figured it
But
out.
yeah, the other thing is going back to YouTube is like, when I first started the program, you're right, like Instagram was a space for interiors as well as for like moms, families, lifestyle. Those were the categories I like really aimed for to start. Cooking has been one that over the past year we've really started to lean into a lot more, specifically for the thing that you mentioned. Like it's super organic, it can work really well for video,
Totally.
and we're totally aiming to do more of that. But there was just a lot of with video, it just takes more time to produce. There's more edits. So
It's more
I was like, I don't
expensive.
think, yeah, it's more expensive. I was like, I don't think I could scale this as quickly. So I just prioritized
Yeah.
Instagram. And that was working. So we kind of really leaned into that as much as we could.
Totally. And it makes sense because you don't get the content that you get on Instagram on YouTube, right?
Yes.
So, and that's been a pretty big part of your play. So I get it. I'll accept that's a fair strategy. I'm just gonna say, I think you guys should check out YouTube. Now that you're crushing it on Instagram, you've got a viral video on TikTok. YouTube is the only platform left to conquer. I think you can
You're
do
absolutely right. Yes.
it.
100% agree.
So thinking about like, you know, you've been at Ruggable for 3 years, 2 years,
Little over two, yeah.
a little over two. Okay. So I read something somewhere. I don't know if this is true, but what I read was that you guys have worked with over 3,000 influencers. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's over 4,000 at this point.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so when you're scaling this, where did you guys? This is a question we get a lot. So, in full disclosure, we don't have technology as part of our like actual service. The way that we provide technology to our clients is that we partner with people. So we'll partner with Creator
Okay.
IQ, we're partner with Tagger. We go out and evaluate what we think are the best services, and then we offer them to our clients. So just, you know, just there's no competition here, I guess, just to let you know. But thinking about how to scale a program, like what was that process for you? Because usually what I see is people start out in like Google Docs, right? So what was your flow on that? Because it gets heavy, right? You got to think about product fulfillment. You got to think about contracts. You got to think about payment. It's quite a bit of work.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Google Docs is my forever muse. Like it's mm-hmm. just the most collaborative, easy to use. Everyone's familiar with it. But I immediately, so coming from an agency when I joined Ruggable, I knew that, and this was also a mandate from the company that they wanted to build things in-house.
Yep,
so I was immediately started looking for SaaS platforms to bring on. We ended up working with Aspire IQ.
Nice.
And at my previous role at the agency, we had done some demos because we were thinking about maybe turning our internal tech into a SaaS tool. And we were kind of trying to suss out competition and see what people were focusing on. And I remember they were Refluence at the time. I remember that theirs stood out to me because they had such a strong like project management workflow within mm-hmm. it. And so, you know, you take away the discovery, you take away the analytics, both of which are super important. But to me, I wanted something that, like I said, could scale. And I needed something that could manage a lot of collaborations mm-hmm. coming through it, you know, all the time. And to me, they were the best. And that doesn't mean that, like, they were without fault. In fact, I provided them with so much feedback in that first year that they actually asked me to join their customer advisory board because I was like, this needs to be fixed. This needs to be prioritized. Yeah. Like, send this to your team, P1, let's go. Like, mm-hmm. I promise you, every client across your ecosystem is going to be asking you for this. Please do this. And they listened to me. So that was really cool.
It's awesome.
But yeah, I remember I did demos with Tagger. I did demos with Creator IQ as well. Yeah. And they're all really strong. You know, what it came down to for me was that project management workflow. I felt like it was the most organic and like natural to use. And again, wasn't perfect, but was something that I could, as I was onboarding new team members and they were taking over collaborations, I could still have visibility into them. Mm-hmm. We could still, you know, segment and create unique campaigns and have specific guidelines and deliverables all set up within it that streamlined. I felt like I could really streamline and scale the fastest with that. So that's what I went with.
And do you guys use them for like where are you storing all this content that you guys use for whitelisting? Right? Is it, do you have Dropbox, ridiculous KV Dropbox full of stuff, or how does that work?
It is Google Drive. So mm-hmm. they had an integration where all of the content that was submitted for approval, approved, gone live, was being fed into this Google Drive folder and then separated out by like campaign, by influencer. I think you could also even look by like post types. That was really cool. And that was working for a while until we were getting like, you know, with each collaboration, there was, you know, 3 to 10 stories and an in-feed post. And so very, very quickly scaled out of control. And we brought on another tech called Canto. And this is like a digital asset management system. So now we actually had so much content that we had to start like throwing stuff in the trash before bringing it in there.
Wow.
And everything is like tagged, cataloged. So again, going back to like making it as easy as possible for the rest of the marketing org to find the influencer content, to pull it out, use it however they see fit. That was the goal. So I think mm-hmm. it works pretty well. It does still require like individual tagging. You know, we have team members who do it, but you know, that's just one of those things that just has to get done.
Yeah, exactly. It's not fun, but otherwise it's a garbage in, garbage out situation.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense. And are you guys, when you're working with influencers, do you typically just buy the content outright? Or do you, like, I know a lot of times when we work with, we work with the automotive space a ton, right? And they don't really need the content for forever. They need it for like a year because then the new model comes out and that becomes irrelevant. But for you guys, it's like you may have old styles that are no longer, you know, popular, but realistically, this could be evergreen content. So how do you approach that?
Yeah, we do buy it outright, like in perpetuity and ubiquitous usage.
Smart.
So you never know when the team may be like, we had this asset that was absolutely amazing 2 years ago. And, you know, where do we find it? And then we kind of walk them through how we tag things and then they do find it and it all works out. I think that Luckily for us, like you mentioned, like we're not, our products are not, well, they are evolving regularly. Like we're coming out with new products
Sure.
and new designs all the time. But there's a couple of designs that were in like the absolute first batch of designs that we ever created who are still top sellers. Like it's just
Yeah.
people love traditional designs. One
Well,
of
rugs are
them has like,
expensive, so you don't go trendy as much as you would with some other, like, decoration in your house, right?
right, but we're also trying to change that because,
Yeah,
like,
that's
obviously,
true.
we want to sell as many rugs as possible. So, the fact that ours are interchangeable, like, we're creating campaigns around seasonality and interchangeability so that when spring comes, you have a floor rug that you can lay out, and when the holidays come, we have holiday rugs that you can lay
I
out
love
and be
that.
more festive. So, yeah, and what's beautiful about that is even though for each, seasonal campaign or whatever, we do typically come out with a few designs to support it. We
Okay.
also just kind of relaunch marketing campaigns around all the existing rugs. So there's still that evergreen content is still relevant and still used.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think it's smart. I mean, it's even a few years ago, though, I think it was much harder to get influencers to just give up the content without like these exorbitant fees. I think because what was happening is a lot of people were going into Google and they were typing in like how much to outright buy out for blah blah blah, and Google comes back with like $5,000. It's like, no,
Right.
so
I think the
it's
market has kind of adjusted a little bit, so
I
it's a little bit
agree.
more reasonable. But also, we've seen generally influencer rates increase across the board in the
Of
past
course.
year.
Yeah,
There's
especially in the
that,
micro section.
yes, definitely. There was a huge reckoning where everybody was like, stop accepting exposure as payment. And like, I
Exactly.
get it. I'm in support of that. I think people should get value and get
Sure.
paid for the work that they do. I'm still going to try to, we still have a gifting channel as part of our program. And for certain creators, I would struggle to honestly say that there is a value by which we should be paying you $500 or $1,000 for this, because
Plus a
we look
rug.
at it plus a rug, right? Which can retail for like up to $550 itself. So I think that that's a pretty strong value.
Yeah.
And people can disagree and we can all negotiate. What I tell my team is like, there's some people who we have said like, we can't offer you payment, but we can offer a rug and yada yada yada, and they get like really upset about that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, look, this is a negotiation, this is a partnership, like we have to feel like we're both getting something out of it. And if we ultimately decide like if it's not worth it to us, then here's what we can offer you. And it's not take it or leave it, but it's there it is. And I think that for creators, there was definitely a slingshot effect where there was some who started to be like, no, absolutely not. Like you have to pay me $1,000 for one image, and we're like, sorry, like we're not trying to be jerks, but that's not going to be worth it to us,
Yeah, totally.
So
Well, I mean, it's to your point, it's value for everyone, right? And I think
yeah.
that's even one of the things that when I started the social standard, I was really focused on, right? Because coming from, Hello Society was one of the like original sort of when it was MCNs and blogs and stuff, and it was a lot of like just try to like cut throat, get as much out of the influencer as possible. Influencers were trying to get as much out of brands, and no one was thinking about long-term partnerships because we never knew where any of this was going, right? It was a total nightmare. But starting the social standard, and even in the name, the social standard, one of our goals was to kind of set the standard. And one of the standards we always wanted to set was like, hey, we're the middle person. We can bring you guys together. We can figure out how everyone can work really well together. And then ideally, this turns into a long-term partnership that's better for everyone, right? And so I think it's important that people remember that, yeah, value for both sides is absolutely critical.
Yeah, I absolutely agreed.
And I mean, when you think about, okay, so almost you're approaching 4,000 influencers, let's say, just for the sake of argument here. How do you guys look at influencers, right? Are you, when you're thinking about payment, are you sort of tiering people out based on the follower count and saying, all right, this follower count and below is product only. Here it's this, here it's that. I know that Dr. Squatch, if you know the men's sort
Yes.
of personal care line, I know 2 years ago they were doing something along those lines. Now they're much bigger and they do bigger integrations. But is that an approach that your team has taken just for, I mean, scale and efficiency?
To a degree, I mean, influencers set their own rates, and I'm okay with that. So we kind of typically will make an initial offer, or we'll just straight up ask for their rates and negotiate from there. But yeah, you know, we have really vague guidelines for team members around what we think would be worth it. But it also, it includes what we want the collaboration to be about. Like not every collaboration at this point is about posting. Some of it is just about content creation. So like, that's not going to be a, you know, how much do you charge for a post, it's how much do you charge for an image, and we want to get 10 images to license or whatever. So and on top of that, like, you know this, and followerships are flubbed, everybody's buying followers, so I take that with a grain of salt, and we're always looking at obviously engagement rates and previous data of collaborations to get as good of an idea as possible about what has worked in the past and what has not. Great example of this is we went overboard on the data like aggregation, and we were looking at data points like, if they do an Instagram story, is the camera forward facing or back facing? Is it selfie style? If they're a mom, is their kid in the content? Like, are they showing a spill? And it honestly became just a little bit too unwieldy to actually, you know, make heads or tails of. But the best example is really more broadly, one of the first verticals that I went after was pets. I was like, pet influencers.
Makes sense.
Every use case we hear is people being like, oh, my dog had an accident on the rug. I had to throw it away. That's why it's so nice that it's washable. Total bust. Like, nope. We could not sell a rug via a pet account to save our lives.
Really?
We tried a lot of different creatives. Yeah, like, it was... I think honestly, my main theory is that, and I don't want to like discourage other marketers from working with pet influencers. I think they're fantastic, and the content created there is amazing. But we just didn't see an ROI, and I think it's just because the audiences there are looking for cute content. Like, they're just they're not trying to be sold to in that lane.
Sure.
And I get it. Like, my TikTok feed is almost exclusively like really cute cat and dog videos. And, you know, I scroll through the ads because it's just not what I'm looking for. It's kind of when I'm there, I'm there.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I think like from a payment perspective, that was a little bit off topic, but from a payment perspective, we have, you know, vague blocks, areas of gray that we think we can assign a certain value to based off the data that we have acquired and based off what has worked in the past. And then we just kind of negotiate from there. It's really tough to set a standard because it's really all over the board.
Yeah. And you make a good point. I mean, you're right. Influencers set their rate. I think we have that discussion with brands a lot where I say, this is what we think it probably should be.
Yeah.
They're going to tell us. Now, you can walk away from that, right? Because it's a free market, right? It's probably the truest form of free market out there, right? So it does interesting. But I actually think that the gray sort of, if you will, in terms of pricing is where brands can see a lot of value, because there are also people who just don't charge that much, right? And you can get a lot of great value out of that. And then you can swing for the fences with somebody who's a little bit more expensive and test it. I think it allows you to have a nice like test and learn approach, right?
Yeah. TikTok, I think, is the main opportunity there. There's so many creators popping up. And, you know, I don't want to say like you take advantage of these creators by paying them less. Like,
not at all.
They're able to negotiate their own rates. They determine what they feel they will do the work for.
Yep.
But like you mentioned, YouTube is more expensive because it's that legacy platform where people have been on it, and they've been able to like really establish, there's a lot of data to prove out what makes sense and what you should charge for the number of views you're getting on a video. Instagram has reached that point as well, where it's become pretty, you have a pretty good idea of what it will cost for this or that. Obviously, like, you always run into people where some random brand decided to pay them, just way overpay them, and you're like, and that now they're saying that that's their market rate, and I'm like, are you sure though? Because I cannot pay you that. Like, it's not going to be worth it for us, so we have to pass. And TikTok is just so much opportunity. Like, there's, and not only that, like, the most creative people. Like, I get so pumped up about the people, the creators coming out of TikTok, because
Oh, totally.
there's so much bang for your buck. And even from looking through the lens of like, can this content be used and perform in an ads perspective? Like, all
Yep.
the TikTok ads look like organic videos, and
They
that's
do.
done on purpose. And I love it. It just makes the whole experience a lot better.
Yeah, it's fun. And I mean, TikTok influencers too haven't, just going back to that maturation comment, they haven't, a lot of them haven't quit their jobs to be influencers full
Yes.
time. Right now, there are some people who definitely fit that mold and are always will be. But, a big segment on TikTok are actually people at work showing you, like, we just were looking at Chipotle and an employee showing you how to make dragon sauce, which is like the super spicy sauce and the sour cream mixed together, and then you dip,
Ooh.
whatever you're eating. It sounds delightful. I'm very
Yeah.
interested to try it. But that's someone at work who is showing you what to do, right? And I think that's great because those people are employed and they're doing TikTok. So it just kind of it creates just a different economy. I feel like everyone that I talk to on Instagram, that is their full-time job, right? I mean, creator economy is definitely real. I'm glad people are sort of recognizing it for what it is now.
Yeah. Oh, same. I'm like really excited, and with the announcements that Zuckerberg made last week or 2 weeks ago, they're like really investing in the creator economy. Like, I'm happy to see it. I think the more ways that we offer creators to get paid and to make money, the better content we'll see, the more opportunities there will be for brands to do really cool things that are finally going to be outside of like this
Totally.
really structured productions, viewpoint. And I think in the next 5 to 10 years, like, we'll see influencers and content creators become like the engines for a lot of not just content, obviously, but like brand content.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it makes sense. It's going to be a huge weight off of the brand's back as well, I think.
Yeah,
Just figuring all of that out.
it's gonna become a new kind of gold rush to like lock creators in as like creative directors, as like in-house leaders for social and otherwise. And like, I know a lot of brands are doing this, and it's actually something that Ruggable is considering as well. But I think just from a right now, it's only in like a testing capacity, and it makes headlines if some brand is like, oh, they hired this Gen Z TikToker to be their creative strategist. I think it will become the norm, and I'm excited for that, because like, if you can find somebody, obviously if they have a built-in audience, that's amazing. That's the core of an influencer. But somebody who really resonates with a brand and their own ethos, and then helps them to support and create content to further their cause, it's just a home run on all sides.
Oh, totally. I think that makes a ton of sense. That'll be exciting to see. But I know you see, I feel like every week in Ad Week, they're talking about like so and so puts out an ad for Nerf's a chief TikTok officer, or whatever it is. It's just too funny. But I mean, it shows how out of touch a lot of these bigger brands are with social media and been out of touch for a while. And I think TikTok just, it was like the nail in the coffin for a lot of these guys. They're like, all right, we've got to figure this out now. Now we're three platforms behind what's cool and what's trending, right? We've got to figure it out. You guys seen much success, and this may be out of your wheelhouse, but have you seen much success with the shop on Instagram?
It is so not really. I think we've seen like a good amount of like add to carts and some bookmarks. People are like kind of saving it for later. And to be honest, you're right, it's not something I'm like actively monitoring, so I don't want to say the wrong thing.
Sure, fair enough.
But I am really excited about just the fact that it's there. And I think one of the issues we actually ran into was, and I don't know if this is still the case, but I remember talking to the Facebook team about Shop, and I think that they required like delivery within 7 days. And our rugs are made to order, so we're not like pulling it off the shelf and sending it as soon as you order it. And so I think that was a hurdle that I'm not sure if we've ever been able to clear. And so for us, it was just about like, all right, it's fine. We have trackable links and direct links to products through Curate, which I think is Bazaar Voice now. And like, that like to buy, Yes. Link in bio.
Yeah.
So like we just use that instead. And for us, honestly, that's okay, because as much traffic as we can drive to the website, that's all great. Then we retarget them, yeah. You know, we get them on our email newsletter.
Exactly.
It's all good for us. So yeah. The shop was kind of interesting. I don't think we ever really pursued it. But there's other things coming down the pike that I am really excited about, like the affiliate program. Through Instagram.
Exactly. That's what I was going to ask you, is like, will that change? Because the affiliate program, the way that I understand it, is somebody posts the picture of the rug and then they can do affiliate linking. If you click over to it and they buy it on Instagram, then they get the money. But the thing is like, if they see the rug and then they don't feel comfortable buying it on Instagram for whatever reason, or they just forget about it and go back, like, how do you track that? I feel like you lose a step in the funnel, on the tracking funnel a little bit.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense for Instagram. And me personally, it's like, if I want to click over and buy something, I mean, hell yes, right? Like, that is so much easier. But, you know, I'll do it for a $25 product. There's no way I'm doing it for, you know, a $100 rug.
Right, exactly. Like, great. Good on Instagram to try to, like, grease the slide as much as possible towards purchase. But you're right. Like, especially on Instagram, with a higher average order value product like ours, you're going to maybe bookmark it and, or like send it to your partner and then go on Amazon, go on Wayfair, do some competitive shopping, decide if you ultimately really want that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And that's another vertical that we've spun up, like just around community. We've tried to provide a place where people can, and we're thinking about implementing this on the site as well, just around like, helping you decide on what design you actually want. Cause we have over 750 designs on the site. So it can be obviously like a lot to consider when you're trying to pick out a rug.
Oh yeah.
And so like we started doing this Facebook group where you can have like interior design experts kind of help you figure out what, you know, people are literally posting images of their living room being like, help me decide what rug I should get in this space. And then people are commenting, being like, how about this one? How about this one? So it's really cool to see the community kind of coalesce around it.
I'm going to have to get on that, because I need a rug for my living room as well. We just moved into a new house at the end of October.
Oh, cool.
And awesome. it's a different size, so I need a much larger rug. So maybe I'm going to check out that Facebook group when we're done here and see what people suggest.
Do it. Style and Design by Ruggable. I'll plug it right here.
Right. There you go. Exactly. Hey, buying a rug is like, for me, it's a stressful event, right? Because I'm like, am I going to like it? Is this going to, like, you know, you just never know.
Yeah, totally. It's a design choice that is actually pretty substantial. People kind of overlook it a lot. But yeah, like if you have a dark floor and you go with a light rug, like that will stand out like crazy. You have to make sure it fits with your couch and your coffee table and all that other stuff.
All the things. Yeah. Well, some interior designers even say you start with the rug. And then you build up. So
we are big advocates of those interior designers, because we agree. Like start with the rug, build up from there.
But the nice thing about Ruggable is that you're right there. You're not paying $3,000 for a rug. So if you buy it and 2 years later, you're like, I'm going to move this to a different room. I need to freshen it up here a little bit. You can do it.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of flexibility there.
It does. Yeah. It gives good flexibility. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you too is I saw a stat that when you guys started implementing influencer content into paid ads, that your return on your ad spend increased 32%. So I saw that on Aspire IQ's website, actually.
I was like, where was that? Oh yeah.
how did that come together? Like, how are you? I mean, that's a big number to increase return on ad spend, right? So is it just really coming down to the content, or is it kind of a strategy like content plus launch plus, you know, 500 million things?
Yeah, I, to be honest, I think it's a 5 million things altogether. Yeah. I think the creative content, the core image at the center is obviously the driver. It's the biggest factor. But we created an entire like methodology testing flywheel where we like hypothesize, we create content, we test it, we analyze the results, we do it again, and it goes in circles. And it's things as detailed as like putting, you know, the banner on the image from the bottom to the top or along the side, or, you know, adding a gradient, or where does the text overlay go, or is this too close up, or is this too far away? Like we're as I'm sure many teams are, we're just looking at what we're seeing. We're looking at the click-through rates, the CPCs, the conversion rates, the CPA, obviously, and just saying, like, what's working here, what isn't. The moment something strikes, we're like, okay, let's do more of that. And if something totally falls flat, we really try to analyze it to understand whether it's something that could be improved with a small tweak, something that can be done in post, or something that is, you know, even like the caption of the ad itself, if it's on Facebook or Instagram.
Oh, totally.
It's just, that's pretty much it. I think what has worked truly at the baseline level for influencer content is that it has, it's the right mix of aspirational but attainable. Mm-hmm. You know, for specifically on Instagram, people love this glossy finish, this really brightly, you know, natural light. Boho is super, super trendy. And those work. So we look for those homes. We look for those creators who can style and have that aesthetic to create content with. But additionally, there has to be, it can't be overly like produced. It can't look like it was styled and set up. It's okay if there's kids' toys on the floor. It's okay if there's, you know, a plate with some some food in it still or something. Like, that's good. People want to see that. And so we figured that out pretty early on, and that's been the strategy ever since. It's been like, let's get more real life content. While obviously making sure that the rug looks really good, that it's not like the room doesn't look dingy, like, you know, like, it still has to look nice. But people have to be able to see it and go, oh, that would look really good in my own home. And I think that's what we were able to hit.
Totally. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's such a focus. And when you were talking, it made me think about, you know, if you go back 5 or 6 years, people were talking about housing, like influencer marketing was housed just under a social media team initially, right? And then it sort of moved over to be kind of like with more branding team. And now it seems like, really, if you want to have some gangbuster success, you've got to have the paid and the influencer teams really talking together consistently, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we do. Both from a, here's the content we received, and this is based off the conversation we had last week where you asked for, you know, we had this like kitchen runner that did really, really well. And so we went back to that influencer, asked her to take 5 more angles. So let's test all of those. All the way through to whitelisting, which is like, you know, super becoming a much larger vertical for us. Right. We're starting to see a lot of success there. And, you know, sourcing handles, sourcing testimonials and quotes and like beyond just images, video, like educational stuff and testimonials, I mean, really works really, really well.
Of course, yeah.
But yeah, there's been, from the beginning, I tried to establish a really clear, like, we want to be in lockstep with acquisitions so that whatever they're requesting, we are able to provide and provide a lot of, so that they have the testing capabilities to make it as good as it can be.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, it's, I read, so I think someone, I was snooping on LinkedIn, you know, as you always do, looking at what are people doing. And I saw somebody who had a title that was really interesting. It was like creative content analytics or something along those lines, where it was like, it was absolutely what we were just discussing, where it's this marriage between content, like, is it the right piece of content? And like, what are the analytics tied to it? Because they're not necessarily two separate entities, right? You can't just put up any piece of content and see how it does. It's like, well, you know, the content is very important here. So,
yeah, I think that's a very important position. We don't have that, but we do have a data team that.
Well, it sort of seems like it's you, right? In a lot of ways, you and your team, right?
A little bit. Like, I will never claim to be a data person. I am not that analytical. But our data team is fantastic, and they support us in acquisitions very closely with, you know, any kind of request to understand if something is working better than something else, down to detailed nitty gritty, like we tested this, but it didn't get enough of the budget, so it wasn't statistically significant. So
Right.
like, how do we change the campaign in order to see if this is actually something that is working or just like didn't reach enough people to actually get a good sense of?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. And when you say, I should have clarified this before, when you say whitelisting, the person on your team that's in charge of whitelisting, you mean paid behind influencers accounts, right?
Yes.
Okay,
Yeah, we're
gotcha.
getting advertiser access to their accounts to run campaigns from their handles. On the influencer side, I think it honestly it gets overlooked a lot that like we're putting spend behind their channels. We're showing their channel off to thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, depending on the success of that.
Oh, totally.
Hopefully they're getting some type of followership. It's tough to connect those dots because
Right.
we don't know if they've got other projects going on and like they might be getting followers from elsewhere. But generally, from a paid media perspective, it works really, really well. And we've also seen the branded content tool work really well. So
Okay.
it's whitelisting, but
Yep.
in the little piece underneath it says like in partnership with Ruggable.
Yeah.
Because I think truly like the whitelisting part that works is it's a little bit sneaky. You feel like it's just a typical
Yeah.
piece of content, but that looks beautiful. And what is this about? Oh, this is Ruggable. Cool. I'm going to click on it. But the branded content tool kind of lays it out clear at the top. So when you see it, you're like, oh, I can appreciate that they're being transparent about this
Yeah.
being an ad, but it's
Exactly.
coming from this other account. They clearly vouch for them. The content is strong. Let me click on it. So, we're looking at both as for a mix of like prospecting and retargeting.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. It's and to your point, I mean, about retargeting and all that, it's like everything's about to get a little nuts in that world, anyway, right? So I think
Yeah.
it's better to own the data. It's always been better to own everything, right? It's just a matter of like whether or not you can actually do that. I think about that a lot with the Instagram shop and affiliate and all this. It makes you wonder, like, are you just bouncing from one bad relationship to another bad relationship, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was gonna say like that was another reason that we ultimately felt like it wasn't worth pursuing. Regardless of the other hurdles, is because like we wouldn't get to own the data, we wouldn't get to see what was happening.
Yeah.
And like I said, Ruggable wants to keep things in-house. We want to like get as much information as possible in order to make the most decisions. And the moment we hand that out to others, we're starting to get gaps. And
Yeah,
so,
totally.
Instagram being having a lot of gaps.
Yeah.
That's
Yeah.
tough.
You don't say,
Yeah.
right? That's funny. Well, I did have another question here. I wanted to kind of switch gears a little bit and just talk about the DTC space in general, right? So obviously Ruggable is part of it. It's like the hottest category, I think, especially in the last year. And I know we see even a lot of it right now in the beverage sector. It's gone completely, bananas in terms of like growth, which is pretty cool. But
Yeah.
there's always a new brand pop up, but people are always doing something. You mentioned this before where people sometimes struggle with certain aspects of working with influencers. Like what would be what's one area where you see other DTC brands kind of tripping themselves up when it comes to influencers? Or said another way, what's a piece of advice maybe that you would have for other DTC brands?
Yeah. I think I mentioned this in some capacity earlier in the call, but like, I think brands that are working with influencers purely for posting are leaving a lot on the table. My advice would be to look at working with influencers a lot more holistically and thinking through, like truly taking the time to think through what are all of the options when you consider a partnership with an influencer. It could be content, it could be posting, it could be whitelisting, it could be an ambassador program, it could be affiliate. It could be all of those together or some mixture of two or three of them, whatever it is. The old model of working with influencers, contracting them to post, to create content and post on their channels to reach their audiences is re still relevant, but I think it's like 20% of like the value you can truly see by partnering with an influencer. And so, I've talked to death about the content we've received from influencers. I think we covered that. But another big factor, and this is almost one of the major reasons we work with like macro, like celebrity influencers is high level visibility. Like I've worked with some partners who, after working with them, received a flood of emails being like, I saw this partnership, or like DMs, I saw this partnership you did with X, Y, and Z. That was so cool. I would love to partner with you. And it opens doors, you know. This industry is so relationship based, obviously. And once you spend enough time in it, you start to see a lot of the same people. Just like at IU, it's a campus of 40,000 students, but if you go to the same bar every Thirsty Thursday, you start to see the same people, you know?
Absolutely.
And so it's very similar. I think that there's ways to partner with influencers that has not even been thought of yet. I don't claim to have a crystal ball or know what is coming down the road next. What I'm trying to do is be strategic in thinking about what are our goals for a program, which is, if you're talking about other D2C marketers, it's always going to be like ROI, scale, awareness, reaching new audiences. There's ways to do that beyond just the traditional route. And so that's what I would say is explore that and use influencers as your experts. Talk to them, like ask them these questions because they have amazing ideas. And some of them are trying to make a buck and some of them are in it for the long haul. And many of them are just brilliant creatives who need to be listened to more closely. So do that. Like, let them lead the way. You don't have to come up with these ideas on your own. Just put faith in the people that you trust, that you or yourself are a fan of, and that you think can represent the brand well and aligns with your aesthetic. And truly partner with them. Don't hire them. Don't contract them. Partner with them. Let it be a two-way street where you can learn from them. They can get paid and put something on their resume. They can create really sweet content. And I think that's the way to go. Like there's no, especially looking forward beyond this year, there's no other way through like truly working with an influencer without being able to let them lead the strategy a little bit too.
Totally. I think that's super smart. That's great advice. Hopefully all the DTC folks that are listening are take that to heart. So well,
Hope so.
one final sort of like fun question for you is give me one influencer that's like impacted you or your life or you really follow along on and just, can't get enough of their story. It's a very telling question, so take your time.
Yeah. I don't know. Oh, okay, so there's two that come to mind. One of them people are probably going to scoff at.
Okay.
It's Casey Neistat.
Of course, he's great. We love
But
him.
it's just from a storytelling element. The guy is just an unbelievable storyteller. And a lot of people in the D2C space know that like the way to stand out often is through storytelling. You can't do it by flashiness. You can't do it by often your product. Like a lot of products are, I mean, I think luckily for Ruggable, we're kind of a disruptor in this space, so we're a little bit different. But like for skincare brands, for beauty brands, really tough, you know? And I think it comes down to storytelling. And I wish that he would post more. I know he's like, he had a whole thing and he kind of stopped doing daily vlogging. I wish I could see more of him. But I'll take what I can get. And then the other person is Philip DeFranco,
Oh,
who is
okay.
like a legacy YouTuber. I've been watching him almost daily for like 4 years now since I like really discovered him. And I just appreciate that he, remains vulnerable to his audience. He truly speaks his mind. He tries to be objective about the things that he covers and talks about. And he has just been doing it for so long. He's seen the space from its true inception. And so when he talks about influencers, when he talks about the industry, when he talks about the space, like I really listen closely because this is a guy
Awesome.
who has so much wisdom that like
Sounds like I
is
need to get
great.
him on the podcast.
Highly recommend, yeah.
That's awesome. Very cool. Well, those are both great ads. I mean, Casey Neistat's a personal favorite of mine. We work with him all the time.
Cool.
He's really, really terrific. So glad to hear influencers are definitely a big part of your non-work life as well. So it just goes to
Yeah.
prove the power of influencers, right? If you do it all day at work and you still watch people when you get home, you know it's the real deal.
True.
So
And at this point, when I get home means when I just walk over to the couch over there
Right. Yeah. But you should hopefully pop by the kitchen and pour yourself a drink of something, you know, it can be sparkling water or wine or whatever it is, but hopefully you can decompose a little bit there, decompress. So
Definitely, yes.
cool. Well, Dimitri, it was wonderful having you on. I appreciate all the insights and the candor conversation. This is a great one. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Jess. Really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as I did. If you're interested in setting the standard in influencer marketing, please check out our website, www.sostandard.com, or give us a follow on Instagram and LinkedIn. Be sure to head over to the Social Standard YouTube channel to check out the video version of this show. If you're enjoying this podcast, please support us by subscribing, sharing, or leaving a review.